Good morning.
Kids,
as you can see, you can start heading on downstairs. About a week and a half ago, Peggy and I were at work. It was in the afternoon on a Wednesday, and police came from all different places, and they put barricades on up in front of all the shops and the businesses. You couldn't get in or couldn't get on out. They pretty much put us in lockdown. Not only that, what they did is north of Layton Avenue, they had it barricaded. We're on Pennsylvania, the eastern part of the airport. And so they blocked on off north of Layton Avenue, and they blocked us on off south on Grange. So we're just in lockdown. Anybody have any idea why that was? Yeah, the president was coming in. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So how it works is what he does is they fly him on in to the 440th and his old entourage, and they come out of Grange, and then they turn north on Pennsylvania. Right past their office, and then they take and they jump on 794 because he was going to Milwaukee, and then I think after that he was going to be in Michigan at that point. So even though we know what day he's coming on in, the challenge is it's understandable they don't tell us what time he's coming on in. So really all you can do is you can schedule for a normal day, and you know somewhere during the time of that day everything's going to change. And you just do your best. And you wouldn't think that would be that big of a deal because it usually throws us off at about 20, 30 minutes. But it kind of has a dominoes effect that kind of follows you through the rest of the day. But if it wasn't for this disruption, this whole process that we watch, and we've watched it a number of times there because we've been there for a number of years, it's pretty cool to play on out as you watch it. Because this entourage comes, and usually what it is, it's about 40 to 50 vehicles. And the lead is about a dozen motorcycles, big Harleys and stuff like that. They're coming along, and they got the lights going and everything. And behind them is this whole thing of vans, paramedics, trucks. And interspersed between all that is a number of black SUVs, big black SUVs with a glass tinted really dark. So you can't see inside, obviously. And I counted this last time, I counted seven of them. And so you don't know which SUV, obviously, the president is in. And then just as fast as they're everything's taken away and they're gone. So like I said, it's kind of fun to watch. The challenge, I think, for us where our office is that I think there's a good possibility for a number of reasons. Number one, because the presidential election is coming this November. Number two, because I think Wisconsin's certainly going to be a battleground state. And number three, because the Republican convention is going to be this July. This could be a regular occurrence for us until November. And the fact of the matter is, depending on the results of this election, the hopes of many in this country are going to rise and fall. It's the way it is. And I think most of us realize the contentiousness on both sides, and I want to make sure very clear, on both sides of the aisle is going to be high during these next number of months. Psalm 72 is interesting because it's going to take us on a very, very similar journey. If you would, open on up to Psalm 72. And you'll notice at the very beginning of it, it starts on out with, it says, of Solomon. And sometimes we call it a headline. Sometimes we call it a superscription that it leads on off with the psalm with. It doesn't say for Solomon, by Solomon. It says of Solomon. That is the only time you will see that superscription in any of the psalms. That is it. And then if you go to the bookend of that, the very end, the last verse of Psalm, which Scott read, it says, this concludes the prayers of David, son of Jesse. And then if you'll notice right after that, most of us would have where it says, book three. So when you look at the Psalms, what they are, there's 150 chapters of the Psalms, and they're divided on up into five different books. Psalm 72 is at the very end of the second book. Much of the contents of books 1 and 2 of Psalms are actually by David. And in these first two books, we'll find that there's actually occasional historical references that we can use to kind of see where we fit in the timeline for Israel's history. And in fact, David's life a lot of times. We saw that the last 2 weeks when Kevin taught. 2 weeks ago, he did Psalm 51. And we talk about David crying on out to have his, to be restored, to have the joy of his salvation coming back, to have God not take his spirit away from him. And we can pinpoint that at that point really to the sins that became from Bathsheba and killing her husband Uriah and things like that. And last week, it was Psalm 55. It talked about a betrayal by not just anybody, but by a friend. And at that point, we could probably isolate it either to the betrayal of Absalom or Joab, his right-hand man. So we have these, again, in the first two books, we have these reference points that were given these historical advantages. But in books 3 through 5, 73 through 150, we won't be given those anymore. They're just not there anymore. You'll see in books 3 through 5 where it does say, of David for the superscription. But typically what's happening, instead of being about David's life itself, what it is, it's generally prophetic. He's looking into the future at that point. And for us, Psalm 72, the one that we're going to look at today, is going to be almost kind of a transition psalm from the first two books to the books 3 through 5. So if we try to make sense of why this is, it seems that books 1 and 2 of the Psalms have somewhat paralleled David's life as we read about his life, particularly in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. And for me, what happens is at the end of chapter 72, it's the end of David's life. And what he's doing is he's handing the psalter on off to his son David. So the books of Samuel, in a sense, give the historical accounts of David's life. And then much of the first two books of Psalms, for me, it's almost like looking into David's diary. We can, in a sense, we can look at his emotions, his highs and his lows, his struggles, his crying on out to God, and his prayers again that he hands on up to God. So one of the ways to interpret this psalm today, Psalm 72, with the superscription that says, of Solomon, and then the last verse, verse 20, saying, this concludes the prayers of David, son of Jesse. Especially once we consider the contents of what we're going to get into in Psalm 72, is to understand that this psalm probably is a prayer by David at the end of his life for his son Solomon. So if you would look with me, I'm going to go to 1 Kings chapter 1. Beginning in verse 5. And we're going to get a little bit of a context again where we're at. 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 5. Now Adonijah, whose mother was Haggith, put himself forward and said, I will be king. So he got chariots and horses ready with 50 men to run ahead of him. His father had never rebuked him by asking, why do you behave as you do? He was also very handsome and was born next after Absalom. Adonijah conferred with Joab, son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest, and they gave him their support. But Zadok the priest, Benaiah son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shammai and Rei, and David's special guard did not join Adonijah. Adonijah then sacrificed sheep, cattle, and fatted calf at the stone of Zaholath near En-Rogel. He invited all his brothers, the king's sons, and all the royal officials of Judah, but he did not invite Nathan the prophet, or Benaiah, or the special guard, or his brother Solomon. Then Nathan asked Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king? and our Lord David knows nothing about it. Now then, let me advise you how you can save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go into the king, into King David, and say to him, my Lord, the king, did you not swear to me, your servant, surely Solomon, your son, shall be king after me, and he will sit on my throne. Why then has Adonijah become king? While you are still talking to the king, I will come in and add my word to what you have said. So we see here that Adonijah tries to put himself forward as the new king. Sounds kind of outlandish for him to take that upon himself, but typically as monarchs go, not really. Succession was typically from the oldest to the youngest. And Amon, the oldest son, if you remember, the oldest of David's son, was killed after he raped his sister Tamar. And the next in line was Daniel. The problem is we have no idea scripturally what happened to Daniel. Maybe he didn't want to get into politics. It could be either that or he's just dead at this point. We don't know. Absalom is the next in line, but as we know, he's also dead. So Adonijah is the next in line. So traditionally in ancient civilization, Adonijah would be the next to take the reign. But King David knows that Solomon is the one that God has chosen to succeed him. And it talks about that in 1 Chronicles chapter 22. So we have a battle for who's in charge of the country. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Remember what Ecclesiastes says. There's nothing new under the sun. Solomon is taken down, as we read, to the springs of Gihon on David's mule. And Nathan the prophet, along with Zadok the priest, anoint Solomon to be king over Israel. Now if we move, let's just move a little further along in that story. Stay in 1 Kings and go to chapter 2, if you would. Chapter 2, verse 1. When the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon, his son. I am about to go the way of all the earth, he said. So be strong, act like a man, and observe what the Lord your God requires. Walk in obedience to him and keep his decrees and commands, his laws and regulations as written in the law of Moses. Do this so that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you go, and that the Lord may keep his promise to me. If your descendants watch how they live, and if they walk faithfully before me with all their heart and soul, you will never fail to have a successor on the throne of Israel. So David in this verse gives instructions to Solomon on how to rule justly and with fairness. So as we said, Psalm 72, at least initially, is believed to be a prayer as David's son enters his reign over Israel. You know, when kids are growing on up, there's always a learning curve for them. And this learning curve really is on a lot of different levels. There's the cognitive level, learning how to read and write and math and everything else. And then there's the physical level, running and all athletics and things like that. But there's also a learning curve just flat out dealing with reality. They learn that it's not always the one who studies the hardest who gets the best grades. It's not always the one who trains the most who gets picked for the team. Some kids just have more natural ability than others. But then it goes beyond that, where they see others not playing by the rules and getting ahead, taking advantage of others, especially the vulnerable, and benefiting from it. This dose of reality often lends it to a common phrase that we hear: it's not fair. And just because you're not a kid anymore doesn't mean you don't still feel like that at times. A drunk driver gets in an accident, he walks away while he leaves the person in the other car dead or disabled for life. In fact, I bet we could spend the next half an hour or so with you guys giving me examples of injustices around us that you have seen. Things that are just not fair in life. I don't think that would be that difficult at all to spend a half an hour coming up with stuff. So as we jump into Psalm 72, we see David. He's praying for his son Solomon, but particularly regarding his new leadership role as a king. Let me read if we can. Let's get into Psalm 72. Read verses 1 and 2. Verse 1. Endow the king with your justice, O God, the royal son with your righteousness. May he judge your people in righteousness, your afflicted ones with justice. Endow the king with justice, with your righteousness. David, a man after God's own heart, realizes that the world, including his own country, is full of injustice, some which he really created himself by decisions he made. And he's asking God to give his son those characteristics that are inherently God's characteristics, those things which define God. More than anything else, David wants his son to be a conduit in which God can enact his righteousness and his justice to his people. Let's jump over, if we can, to verses 3 and 4. May the mountains bring prosperity to the people, the hills the fruit of righteousness. May he defend the afflicted among the people and save the children of the needy. May he crush the oppressor. We see in these verses that a big part of reflecting God's righteousness and justice is for the king to defend the afflicted, to save the children of the needy, and in pursuit of those doing those things, it says the land and the people of the land will prosper. What often separates the kings or leaders in general who pursue godly justice is that they come to the aid of those who typically have no defenders. And for American politics, those who can't cast a vote or contribute any money. Those who can't do anything to bolster a politician's status because of their lonely status. And in such cases, there's nothing personally to gain other than the fact that what they're doing is right in the eyes of God. But often it's politically detrimental. David knows to pursue God's agenda is ultimately in the best interest of all those under Solomon's reign, even if they can't appreciate it, even if they don't understand it, or even if they're in opposition of it. Unfortunately, what we see in politics today is a desire to do what's ever necessary to stay in power. Where one side hopes the other side doesn't succeed while it's their turn in charge, even if succeeding would benefit the citizens of this country, so as not to bolster their opponent's position. And both sides in American politics are guilty of this. In the last part of verse 4 that we just read, David asks that the king may crush the oppressor. We've heard this word crush before in Genesis 3:15. God says to the serpent, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and his and hers. He will crush your head and you will bite at his heel." So as we move through the psalm, we're starting to see that humans, even David's son, probably can't completely fulfill what we're reading. David is progressively looking at a time beyond Solomon, although for me it's tough to exactly know when that transition verse may be. Let's look, if we can, at verse 6 and 7. May he be like rain falling on a mown field, like showers watering the earth. In his days may the righteous flourish and prosperity abound till the moon is no more. This is one of those verses, again, certainly could be for Solomon or could be beyond Solomon. As we jump to verse 8, though, I think we're going to see this start to change. Verses 8 through 11. May he rule from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. May the desert tribes bow before him and his enemies lick the dust. May the kings of Tarshish and the distant shores bring tribute to him. May the kings of Sheba and Seba present him gifts. May all kings bow down to him and all nations serve him. So it says from the river to the ends of the earth. The river is probably referring to the Euphrates, where the Garden of Eden is thought to have been. And so he's talking about the center for where life started to the ends of the earth, from sea to sea. So it's kind of a weird statement to attribute to Solomon at this point, especially Solomon is going to reign over a landlocked country. And I'm not aware at this point of Solomon having any type of world domination type goals like Napoleon. So by the time we get to verse 11, we see that David is asking that this king who sits on the throne will be a king of kings, that all kings will bow down to him and all nations will serve him. So I think at this point, it's text is certainly suggesting something beyond Solomon. And if you would notice, if you look at verse 12, it begins with the word for. We've talked about this before. The word for basically means because. If you stumble on a for, it's a bad place to start a Bible study, because really what you're doing is you're plopping yourself down in the middle of a conversation, and you're only getting part of it at that point. As we've read again in verses 8 through 11, it reflects that this king will be a king of kings and that all nations will serve him. And then you essentially have the word for or because, which essentially means whatever comes after the word for is the reason that this king will be king of kings. So before I read verses 12 through 14, think about what would be the most typical reason anybody would be elevated to a position of king of kings. In other words, if a ruler wanted to have authority over other kings, over other countries, over other empires, what would be necessary in the world's view to allow that to happen? If you remember a couple weeks ago, I talked about Assyria. Talked about they had the power, they had the weapons, they had the numbers, they had the money, everything that they needed to take and have world domination. So let's read, if we can, verse 12 through 14 and see what David says, why all kings should bow down to this one and all nations serve him. For he will deliver the needy who cry out, the afflicted who have no one to help. He will take pity on the weak and the needy and save the needy from death. He will rescue them from oppression and from violence, for precious is their blood in his sight. So what's the reason this king that David talks about is going to be king of kings? Because he'll deliver the needy? He takes pity on the weak? He rescues those from oppression. In other words, the reason this king is going to be king of kings is because he's so merciful. He's so loving. These things that I read would make no sense for the nations around Solomon to fear him. With these attributes of grace and love and mercy, wouldn't this be the guy that would be the easiest to conquer? We're at a point in the psalm where every sense it appears that David is certainly speaking beyond Solomon, speaking beyond Solomon's children, his grandchildren. He's speaking of the Messiah. He's speaking of Jesus Christ. In fact, if you consider Jesus, his first coming, we've just talked about it, Palm Sunday, how did he come into Jerusalem? On a foal, a colt of the donkey, riding lowly and with righteousness. David, a man after God's own heart, knew that no one could be king of kings unless his kingship was marked by justice, mercy, and love, the qualities of God himself. This is what makes the difference in leadership in God's eyes versus the world. The world looks at power, intimidation, rising to the top by climbing over the backs of others, taking advantage of any perceivable weakness or mistakes that one opponent might make. Sounds like politics 101. Verses 15 through 17. Long may he live. May the gold from Sheba be given him. May people ever pray for him and bless him all day long. May grain abound throughout the land on the tops of the hills. May it sway. May the crops flourish like Lebanon and thrive like the grass of the field. May his name endure forever. May it continue as long as the sun. Then all the nations will be blessed through him, and they will call him blessed. We see again that this reign of Christ will last forever, and all nations will be blessed by him. Again, a position that only Christ can fill. So what can we take from this psalm? There are several things that I come away with. First, like David, let us seriously pray for our leaders, our mayors, the governor, the vice president, the president, even if, maybe especially if you don't agree with them politically. Look at Kings, if you would. We're in Kings chapter 3, 1 Kings chapter 3. Starting in verse 7. Now, Lord, my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, but I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours? The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked this, so God said to him, since you have asked for this, and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and a discerning heart. This blessing that Solomon is receiving that we just read about really, really had its origins when David cried on out to God in prayer in this Psalm 72, endow the king your justice, O God, the royal son with your righteousness. About 30 years ago, Peggy and I have been married for probably about 7-8 years. Peggy decided to take and run for the school board in St. Francis. And it's great. And so she had those yard signs made up. And I remember going around St. Francis putting those yard signs on in. And he had brochures. And I was knocking on the door. I had one of the kids in my arm knocking on the door. It looked good. Came to time of election, she won. You finished that term, and you ran again, and you won again. But one of the things that I found, just as a kind of a bystander, is that I looked at St. Francis as being the smallest of the communities that surround Milwaukee. And I looked at the school board as kind of being the bottom rung of entering into politics, if you think of a ladder. And I watched being in the smallest community, in the smallest, on the bottom rung, and I watched the backstabbing and the cutthroat, and unbelievable. I was just blown away by it, and because of that, Peggy didn't pursue it beyond that. I'm really glad that some people want to go out for politics, because if everybody was like me, you would literally go to the ballot box, and it'd be an empty sheet. you know? So I'm really, really glad that some people want to do it. It's a tough job. It really is. And even if you start with pure motives, and I believe so many people do start with pure motives, in that atmosphere, it's really, really tough to keep your bearings. And understand that God can work through unbelieving leaders in prayer. He does it all. We see it all the time throughout Scripture. He affects their lives and their decisions and things like that. So we have to keep on praying for them. Second of all, let's hunger and thirst for justice like Christ does, to have passion for the afflicted and for the needy. Time and time and time again, we see Jesus' concern for the downtrodden and less fortunate, so much so that he correlates our concern for them to our love for him. If you would, look at Matthew chapter 25. Starting in verse 34. Then the king will say to those on his right. You know what? I'm actually going to back on up. I'm sorry. When the Son of Man comes in verse 31, comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. And this is how he separates from sheep to goats. Then the king will say to those on the right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go visit you? The king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters, you did for me. Micah does such a good job summing on up what God expects from us. You don't have to turn there. You can just listen. Micah 6, starting in verse 6. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings? With calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with the thousands of rams? With 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So the question today is, where's your hope? Where's your hope for you, for us, for our family, for our neighbors, for our community, for our state, for our country? Is it at the ballot box this November? And I'm not saying don't vote. It's a wonderful privilege, and we should all take advantage of this process. But really, where is our hope? There's a military statement that has the soldier ask himself, is this the hill I'm willing to die for? Is this the battle I choose to fight? I have personally seen too many people say, yes, this is the battle I choose to fight in response to politics. And in doing so, have seriously damaged relationships with friends and family. Fortunately for us, Golgotha was the hill where Jesus took his stand. Realize even David's ultimate hope was not in his son Solomon. Even with all his wisdom, his hope was in a King of Kings who would reign with righteousness and justice forever. And let's hold on to that. One of my favorite songs is, "My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. On Christ, the solid rock I stand. All other ground is sinking sand." If you have any other prayers that you would like to take and bring on up for the congregation, please do. Otherwise, stand and we'll sing.